This podcast is brought to you by our Supreme Boiler of Leather, Morgan. If you want to find out how to become a Supreme Boiler of Leather or how to get access to the exclusive Patreon content, check out patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Hello everyone and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I am your host as always, Stefan Sasse, and today with me is one illustrious co-host I wanted to have on the podcast for quite a while but never got around to, and he is going to introduce himself now.
Well, my name is Javier Marcos. Javier Marcos, I'm Spanish. First things I want to say, for me it's a real pleasure to be talking in the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. It was the first podcast I ever heard about this, about A Song of Ice and Fire. And for me, it opened the window of a new world of fandom, of theories, of course, the Boiled Leather Audio Award, the Tumblr of Stefan, of Santi Collins. And as you can hear with my strong accent, I'm Spanish, and it's my first long podcast recorded in English about A Song of Ice and Fire. So please forgive me if I do a big mistake in English, because it's not my first language. I am not, like, I don't have the same expertise in the language as Stefan has.
Oh my goodness, you are so kind to me. Now listeners have to endure my German accent, your Spanish one, and overblown ego, now freshly puffed by you. thank you very much for all the kind words. I mean, we've been kicking around for quite a while now. This would be interesting, actually. If you are listening to this podcast, tell us since when you are listening to it, because, I mean, we've been doing this since 2011, so it would be nice to hear if someone is with us for this whole time, basically.
I didn't discover you in 2011, but I think it was around 2013, I think 13 or 14, because I discovered the Nerd Stream era. That is, for me, like a place that you have to visit. You know, it's not like the biggest and most beautiful website in the world, and I know it's yours, Stefan, but the kind of content that is there, the quality of the content, of the theories, of the analysis, of the what was the name? The Supreme Court of Westeros Roundtable, that I was invited there a few times. And it was really, really astonishing, and of course Stefan was very nice, because the theories and essays that he was posting in Tower of the Hand, he posted also there. And really, if you just listen to the podcast and you don't know the Nerd Stream era, I think it would be quite weird, because Stefan, I think, is more known for his written analysis of A Song of Ice and Fire than for the podcast, I think. Because as I always say, Stefan is very famous, I have to say, at least in the Spanish fandom, due to his theories, because I always say that Stefan is the guy whose theories become reality. Because Stefan had two theories, the Southern Ambition theory and the origin of the decay of the Night Watch, how the Night Watch started to decline. And those both that were simple theories were confirmed for me in The World of Ice and Fire. And is that there are the only two things that I can see that George has said, okay, this guy knows what is real, so I will just confirm it in the book. So, and all of this, it was written in Tower of the Hand, and of course, in the Nerd Stream era. So, it's a huge pleasure to be talking with Stefan about, like, everything.
You are too kind, man. It's almost embarrassing right now. I'm standing here and I'm getting all red and puffy in the face, and I'm having these weird fuzzy feelings in the stomach. So thank you very much for saying all of these nice things. And if any listener is now going to, where can I find all those great essays that he's talking about? Of course, on the Patreon. But again, you know that already. So let's dive into the topic of the hour and not waste any more time on puffing my ego up. And we are going to talk today about a minor fantasy book you might have heard about. It's called The Lord of the Rings by that obscure British author J.R.R. Tolkien. I think he modeled his name after George R.R. Martin. It is, of course, The Lord of the Rings. It's the one true precursor of all fantasy, the one fantasy book to end all fantasy, and of course the most successful movie adaptation of any fantasy story up to date, maybe, I guess it still ranks over Game of Thrones in terms of success. At least it opened the door to even imagine doing this on the widescreen, right?
Yes, I always say that I remember this year I attended some TV shows in Spain and talking about Game of Thrones, because I don't know if I told I told that before when there was one presentation. I'm a Spanish fan of A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones, and I speak in a Spanish podcast that is called Podcast de Hielo y Fuego, Podcast of Ice and Fire. But I think I am most known because I'm the owner or the administrator, I don't know how you call that, of the biggest A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones website in Spanish. And I would say in the world, I think we are number two, just under Westeros.org, because we really have a lot of content and a lot of visitors. When there was the show, when the show was on air the last spring, we had like 1.5 million visits per month. That is crazy, because we have a lot of fans from Spain, a lot of from Latin America, because you know they speak Spanish there. So I am like the go-to guy when in Spain they talk about Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire. So I am now making myself ready. It's a bit weird, but I have gone to many TV shows and media, newspaper, always on Spanish. So I remember this year when I was having interviews about what's going to be the legacy of Game of Thrones, what's the meaning of Game of Thrones in the history of television, and my sentence, my statement, my headline for the media was always the same: we nerds have won, because the most awarded movie of all time is Lord of the Rings, and the most awarded, the most yes, the most awarded, the thing that has won more trophies, more Emmy trophies, more Critics Award trophies on television of all time is Game of Thrones. So with both ways, Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, the nerds have conquered like all the popular culture. And if you join in the mix, for example, the Avengers, that I'm not a fan, I just like them, but I don't like the last movie, for example, you just place the three things together: Game of Thrones, the Avengers, and the Lord of the Rings. And sorry, not nerd guys, but we have won.
We absolutely have. I mean, this is
we are in the nerd stream era, as you have stated time ago.
Yeah, and this was my mission statement, basically. You know, if you've never heard or visited the nerd stream era, the general idea behind the name is that nerddom has become mainstream, therefore nerd stream. This was my thesis back when I opened the blog in 2012, and it. I think I have been rather vindicated on the idea, because as you just said, it really is a total victory, at least in the terms of exposure, you know?
No, nobody can argue against that, because nobody can. Everybody knows Game of Thrones, everybody knows Lord of the Rings, everybody knows Avengers. I won't talk about Avengers because I am not a comic fan myself. I just read some mangas, but not Japanese comics, but not Western comics. But the point is that everybody knows who is Gandalf, who Daenerys Targaryen is, who is like the dwarf of the Game of Thrones. If everybody in Spain have heard the sentence, El invierno se acerca, that means winter is coming. You can see tons of memes, of images of popular companies that say, oh, sales are coming, your new car is coming. So there are all references to Game of Thrones. Everybody is now making jokes about Daenerys Targaryen and the ending of Game of Thrones. So we have invited popular culture, but trying to talk about the topic of this podcast, everything started with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and this is kind of weird, right? Because when Lord of the Rings came out, it was a success in its own right. I mean, the books, they were first published in the 1950s, if I'm getting my numbers right. And they were pretty successful back then. I remember that on the extra features on the DVD, they talked a little bit about it, and there was graffiti in the New York subway, like Frodo Lives and stuff like that. But it is kind of a lonely landslide, because nothing else ever came close, and it took like two or three decades for anything fantasy related to even make it into nerddom. You know, when the whole Dungeons and Dragons thing starts, that's the late 70s, basically, and fantasy only gets a little bit of a comeback, but a rather silly one, in the 80s. And so the Lord of the Rings is this exception from the rule, you know, that fantasy cannot succeed, that fantasy is this niche thing, that it's rather silly and stupid, and it takes a long while. And do you have any working theory why it is the Lord of the Rings that broke the mold? Is it the respectability of Tolkien?
Well, I think there are two things that are happening at the same time. First of all, Tolkien is an Oxford scholar, so he's like teaching English in the best place of the world of learning English. He started Lord of the Rings. We'll talk about that later. Just an excuse to invent new languages and to write new maps. That story was only like some story where I can place my invented languages and my invented maps of foreign territories that never existed. So he was an scholar, he was an academical, and everybody respected Tolkien. And the quality of the writing of the book, it's superb. I always say when I got a lot of... I have to say I am very biased in this podcast. I am a member of the Spanish Tolkien Society. Tolkien Society was founded when Tolkien was still alive. And there were some fans that wanted to promote, to make lectures and readings and from an analytical point of view, to analyze and study and promote the work of the writings and the works of Tolkien. And when he was still alive, Tolkien was asked about it, and he said, okay, it's fine if you want to do like research and promote the readings of my poems, because Tolkien has written like everything, poems, novels, almost, I think he has never written drama, but I may be wrong, but he has written like everything. And he said, okay, it's fine. So I'm a member of the Spanish Tolkien Society, so I am really invested in Tolkien. And I always say that the quality of the writing of The Lord of the Rings is not the same quality as A Song of Ice and Fire, because Tolkien was a scholar, was an academic in Oxford, as I said. And George R. R. Martin is a journalist. It's the truth. He studied journalism in Chicago, in Northwestern. So both people cannot write at the same like high literature level. Of course, the writing of A Song of Ice and Fire is superb. The quality, I think they have never created a book so well written in order to be reread, to be written again as A Song of Ice and Fire. But that the Rings has an intrinsic quality, the pure quality of the text due to being written by a scholar. And that's what made, I think, Lord of the Rings so prominent in that time. And 50 years after it ended, it's still like a book that everyone should read. But I know you, Stefan, hasn't read it. Or you have... I think so, no? You just saw the movies.
I know. I did actually read the books, but this has been like 20 years ago now. I was still a student in school, in high school, when I read them. And it was a chore, really. I never found... I had to try several times over, and it was more a sense of obligation. I don't even remember if I really finished them all or if I just gave up when The Scouring of the Shire came about. And I haven't restarted them since. I gave The Hobbit a try actually a few years ago, and I didn't get far with it either. So for some reason, the books never clicked with me. And I think what you just said about the writing, that is a big part of it.
Too high literature. I think when we were talking about, you were talking before, like why Lord of the Rings was a huge success, and then it failed, like the fantasy didn't get a huge boost until the 80s. And I would say the 80s were people... It was time when people were reading fantasy and sci-fi, but it was still considered something geek and nerdy. I think it's only in the 90s. I think that really what made fantasy like popular again is Harry Potter. That may seem crazy, but okay, it's not a high literature at all. It's a book for children or maybe for teenagers, but it's fantasy because, you know, magic isn't real. So they like made people, okay, we can try to read something that is not like, we can read a non-fiction that is not realist, not realistic. So we can maybe try sci-fi, and then of course, A Song of Ice and Fire appeared, but it wasn't so big until now. And the Witcher books appear, and you know, all the Dungeons and Dragons literature was written before, but people weren't really reading them. The Chronicles of the Dragonlance, Discworld. I'm a huge fan of Discworld, but they weren't like mainstream like A Song of Ice and Fire has become. I remember like 4 or 5 years ago when I was in Madrid subway. Every single day, I remember that, I was counting, every single day I was seeing someone reading some of the A Song of Ice and Fire books. Okay, I may be biased because I was going to the university, so I could see a lot of young people there. People that go to the university usually read a lot, so I was maybe going like the best route in order to see people reading books. But you can see every time people reading A Song of Ice and Fire. And that is not what was happening before, people reading fantasy books. before A Song of Ice and Fire and in the period of time between Lord of the Rings and A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, it's also in the publishing, basically. I mean, Lord of the Rings was never in the crap section of bookshops where you usually find fantasy. I don't know if this is a phenomenon in other countries as well, but in Germany, there is this egregious tradition to slap totally random covers on the cheap paperbacks of fantasy stories. If you have ever seen the German covers for Song of Ice and Fire before it became hugely successful and merited special treatment,
yeah, I saw some of those, and they were a bit weird.
Yeah, a bit, just a little bit. The Lord of the Rings, it had a different publisher. The publisher of Lord of the Rings books in Germany usually prints school textbooks and the like. So yeah, this is totally weird, and they come in this little box. They are green, they only have kind of a symbol on them. So they are apart from all the rest in their layout and everything about it, you know. And the translation, the German translation, has become a huge topic all the time. And there are two German translations, and there is a perennial fight over which one is better. Stuff like that, you know. It kept much closer to its roots as this language-oriented, more academic work. You know, it is not something you read exactly for leisurely purposes. It is something you read to show that you are a learned man in some kind. At least that was it before it all became hugely successful with the movies and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think that there was a huge problem because people really try to read that. I think that your case is like, happens to a lot of people. I have to read Lord of the Rings because it's the highest piece of fantasy literature. Tolkien is the father of fantasy, and if I have enjoyed other like fantasy books, I have to read Lord of the Rings. And if you're trying to read something due to an obligation and not because you want it, that's always a huge problem. And that happens a lot with Lord of the Rings, I think. I have to say, if maybe you try to read it now, not because you have the compulsory necessity of reading the book and you just, okay, I am very bored. I think it's very complicated to be bored when you have a life and a job and a family, etc. But it's okay. I may give it a try just because I want. I think you can really enjoy it. For me, there are two parts of The Lord of the Rings that can be very complicated for people. One is the poetry, because some of the language is just to make art of the writing, not to tell you like anything relevant to the story, like a description of the books, of a forest, of the flowers, of a building. It's not something practical, it's just beauty of the language. And the other things are the songs. In The Lord of the Rings, there are a lot of songs. That is something that, for example, was almost totally lost in the movies. But Tolkien loved like writing poems transform into songs. And you can see a lot of songs in The Lord of the Rings books. So if you don't like, you know, there is a scene where two people are talking about and they start singing a song. And of course, if you are not first of all, you may be not an English speaker. And if you are an English speaker, you see a song and you don't get the rhythm of the song because it's just the lyrics. You don't have the music of it. So many people also doesn't like that kind of portion of songs in the texts.
Yeah, and I can perfectly understand that. I always had a little bit of a problem with those songs and lyrics in The Lord of the Rings. And I have to confess, I'm also not the huge fan of the ones that we get in A Song of Ice and Fire. I mean, by now, they are so much part of the DNA of the whole story that I don't have as much problems as back when I read them the first time. But I'm not the song and lyrics guy in fantasy. I don't know why. It may be because I have no connection to music generally. I'm not informed about music, you know. I don't know anything about it. I can't tell you if music is good or anything like that. So it may just be ignorance on my part. But this is one of the many reasons that The Lord of the Rings failed to connect to me, apart from the really weird pacing of it all. And I mean, I remember that the Battle of Helm's Deep is like, what, 2.5 pages at most? And you get endless descriptions of landscapes and all of that. So if you like it, I mean, all the more power to you. But at least 20 years ago, I didn't. And I'm always thinking I should try again, but as you said, time is scarce, and I always have a book that I want to read more than to try Lord of the Rings again. Maybe I'll get around to it sometime. I don't know.
My statement in this podcast is, if you love, and if you are a Patreon or a regular listener of this podcast, if you love A Song of Ice and Fire, I think maybe it's not fair, but you cannot really understand the scope and the themes of A Song of Ice and Fire if you at least aren't familiar with the Lord of the Rings. Maybe with the movies is enough, but I think that you cannot understand what Martin tried to do in A Song of Ice and Fire without understanding Lord of the Rings. And I have to say that Martin has stated several times that he loves A Song of Ice and Fire, he loves the Lord of the Rings, and he has said that every like 4, 5, 7 years he reads again The Lord of the Rings, because he's a huge fan of the books, and he says, every time I read again the Lord of the Rings, Martin says, I discover something new. And for example, one time when he was in Spain, he was asked about what was his favorite character in The Lord of the Rings, and he said, Boromir. And say, okay, if you think that the most interesting or compelling character is Boromir, it really shows how do you understand the world of the characters and the development. And for me, that's pretty interesting.
I'm also a huge fan of Boromir, even from the movies. You know, I really love the character. I even modeled a pen and paper character after him that I played for a while. He speaks to something in me. And so I can perfectly understand where Martin is coming from there. And I also would agree with you. I mean, the influences of A Lord of the Rings are obvious. And I mean, the influences of A Lord of the Rings are pretty obvious in any fantasy, even in a fantasy that tries to stay clear of everything Lord of the Rings related, because then you can see it by omission. No one is getting past the Lord of the Rings. It's almost like if you read like literature of the 19th century and you don't know anything about the Bible, you will mostly not understand quite a lot of stuff. And it is the same in fantasy, basically. This is the seminal text. It is what everyone is starting against or from or with. It depends a little bit on your take on The Lord of the Rings, but I don't see how you can get past it.
You simply cannot. You simply cannot. I wanted to do in this podcast to, I have to say, I made a bit of trickery, because some things I will say will not be my words, but the words of Tom Sippy. If you are not like a huge Tolkien fan, you won't know who Tom Sippy is. Tom Sippy is the biggest alive scholar about Tolkien. He had the cathedral in Oxford. He was teaching about Tolkien and English literature in Oxford since a lot of years. He's like very old now. He's older than George R. Martin. He's like 75, something like that. I don't remember. And I had the huge pleasure, because it's a very, very complicated thing to get around him, this year when he attended the national event of the Spanish Tolkien Society, because he has a daughter that lives in Spain, so he's very old, he doesn't travel to like anywhere, but he was invited to Spain, and he said, okay, it's a huge moment to be with my daughter and stay here. So he went to Spain, he did a conference comparing Tolkien and Martin, because he's a huge Martin fan. As Tom Sippy said, I know a lot about Martin, and I have read a lot of Martin, because he was writing in the same fanzine, sci-fi, fantasy fanzines that I was reading in the 70s and 80s. So I'm a bit older than him, so I has been like following all his trajectory like pretty well. And he's a huge fan of Martin. But of course, he's a huge fan of Martin, but he's like the biggest expert of the world of Tolkien. He has written several books, like the Bible of Tolkien was written by him. So he had some statements comparing Lord of the Rings and A Song of Ice and Fire. I have to say, I don't agree with all of them, but some of them are pretty interesting. So in the podcast, I will say some sentences of the biggest Tolkien fan in the world, and not fan, biggest expert Tolkien fan in the world. And you and I, Stephanie, we can discuss about it, because some are like pretty straightforward, but some may be a bit controversial.
I'm not sure I understand what's controversial now. Okay, could you come again with this?
For example, Tom Sippy has a sentence that he thinks that Martin is like very, very pessimistic. I was arguing with him that, for example, the argument that Tolkien is like, there are several levels in this discussion. But for example, he was arguing that Martin, the Martin views of the world is very pessimistic compared to Tolkien. And he has a sentence that I think is very nice, that he says, Martin Tolkien, the oldest one, shows the world as how the world should be. You know, friendship, alliances with other people, working together to get a goal, and forgiveness, etc. And Martin shows the world how the world really is, not how the world should be. And that's why we get the so complex characters in A Song of Ice and Fire. You cannot almost find a white character in A Song of Ice and Fire. Maybe that was maybe Brienne, but you see a lot of more morally ambiguous characters in A Song of Ice and Fire. Almost every character is a great character compared to Lord of the Rings, that there are almost no great characters. There are a few, but they are like the minority. So Tom Sepia states that there are two different views of the world, and they say Tolkien has a different view of Martin of the world, and in the literature that they write, you can see the difference, because they were living in different worlds. It's not the same world that Tolkien was living, you know, after the Second World War, when the countries are trying to work together to avoid another great war and everything, compared to the world of Martin, like 40 years later, with the war of Vietnam, with the conflict with the Soviet Union, and right now, the world we are living now, with, you know, all the chaos and wars around the world, the crisis of the capitalism. So they see the world in a very different way, and that different views of the world is reflects in the literature of it.
Yeah, I would really agree with this. I was thinking the same thing right now. The different eras in which Martin and Tolkien lived and what they lived through have to inform how they look at it, how they work it out, basically. I have written about this on Twitter lately. There is this one of the weird intersections that we have here. There is this documentary that the director of the Lord of the Rings movies, Jackson, made. It's called They Shall Not Grow Old. And it's this documentary about World War One, in which they took original movie archive movie material and they colorized it and then put over it sounds a little bit, but mostly they used interviews with veterans of World War One and what they were saying. And the weird thing was that those veterans had constantly were framing their experiences in this horrible war, you know, that you could see on the movie material as well, the horrid conditions. And everyone knows how horrid World War One was, right? But they were always framing it in this adventure-like thing, you know, the experience of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And our bodies were dying, but in the end, we all knew that. This very upbeat thing, because I think that was what it was expected. Back in the day, they needed to talk about it like that, because there was no other way to express your feelings. And I guess Tolkien also got a little bit into this, that he couldn't really go into a horrid description of war simply because this was his class and his age cohort basically wasn't used to talk about stuff like this. Whereas Martin, who came out of this protest tradition of Vietnam and this whole war is bad thing, he has no problems, no qualms whatsoever to do this. And so you get these stark differences. I guess that would be one of the big problems there.
Just compare that George R. Martin was an objector and didn't go to the Vietnam War because for political reasons I cannot agree with this war, and he wasn't in the military there. And Tolkien in the other side of the streets decided to go to war to fight for his country, for England, because it was the First World War. It wasn't the war against the Nazis that you can understand, okay, I'm going to fight against the Nazis. No, it was the First World War. It was, you know, just a war. And I think that I think you are German, you have read more about wars that I have read, but the First World War was like the spirit of the romantic idea of war, because there was a whole generation that have never lived a war and didn't know what a war is, and they thought that the war was something like romantic and epic and didn't really understand the horror and the drama and how terrible it is for everyone, for every side the war is. So that's all like very different views of the war. Of course, you can talk about the, of course, Tolkien is a devout, really, really very Catholic guy. You cannot understand. You don't have to be a Catholic at all to read and enjoy Tolkien. But I think you at least have to understand what are the views of the world for Catholic people in order to understand what Tolkien writes and why he writes like that. Even if he has said many times that his books are not like a metaphor of the Bible, of Jesus or anything like that. No, he has read that it's fantasy and don't try to make this as a religious book. But you can see the influence in the same way that you can see in Martin, A Song of Ice and Fire, the influences of being an agnostic guy. Not an atheist, but an agnostic guy. So there are very different views of the world. But in both cases, they both love fantasy. They both creating very compelling characters, and I think I would say they like creating worlds. But it's not. But I wouldn't say that. I think that Tolkien loves to create wars, a world where some people live there, a world where people speak that language, a world that has this kind of map, and Martin just wants to invent stories and create characters that are compelling from those stories. The world is secondary for him. He's not an academical. He hasn't invented a language. He has even asked the people from Game of Thrones in order to make like the Dothraki language, because he hasn't have the knowledge to create a language. But that also shows how both masters of literature view not only their world, but also how they write and they create.
Yeah, I definitely agree on the world building part. And I want to emphasize something you just said about the religion. I recently read the history book Dominion by Tom Holland, who is a great historian. And he wrote this history of, he calls it the making of the Western mind. And it's basically a history of an idea history of Christianity. And in it, he also has the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien as major Christian thinkers. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely true. And Tolkien is very much steeped into this culture, which may be one of the reasons why the Lord of the Rings was received the way it was back in the 50s. Yeah, you know, because people on a God level could come to grips with the religious metaphors in a way that we don't do today, whereas today we can get a lot more out of the fantasy elements than people were able to do back then. That may be true. It's just working theory right now. But
very interesting, because Tolkien is a Catholic guy in a country that is not Catholic. In fact, John, the professor Tolkien, is so devout to Catholicism because how much his mother suffered when he was a child, because his mother was a Catholic, and due to being Catholic, the family of the mother like ejected her and didn't give him any money, and the family was like totally abandoned from the world, because from the family and the grandparents and etc. due to his mother being Catholic. So it's also made like a very devout Catholic Tolkien, just in order to, like, I have to protect what my mother suffered for that was for her faith, for being a Catholic. So in this country of not Catholics, because there are many Catholic people, time ago, now there are more Catholic people in UK due to immigration too. So it's also like, I'm trying to defend my faith, but I say that before and I will repeat it. Lord of the Rings is not a religious book. It's not about religion or about Catholicism, about the Bible. It's a fantasy story that just, if you have knowledge of, you have a understanding of the Christian religion and the Catholic religion, you will really understand some things that Tolkien, I think he wasn't doing that on purpose, but you can see that in the back of his mind, he had that idea, and that idea appeared on the text. In the Silmarillion, you can see a great metaphor of the start of the Bible, but the Silmarillion is a very strange book that I think is not the topic of this podcast, because, of course, Stefan, you have not read the Silmarillion. No, it's a...
I managed like two pages.
I wouldn't compare it to The World of Ice and Fire, because it's different. It's a very strange book. Tolkien didn't finish the Silmarillion. It was his son, Christopher Tolkien, that is still alive. He's like 92, something like that. And it's a very strange, very complicated book. It's very beautiful, it's very well written, but you can see that some parts weren't really finished by Tolkien and were finished by his son. So it shows like all the history of the world and all the First Age and the Second Age. Most of the First Age, the Second Age doesn't appear very much in the Silmarillion. So the TV show that is going to be done by Amazon, I think we will talk about it later, will be from something that is not really written. So that is very interesting. So I won't say more things. It's a very strange book. It's a very beautiful book, but it's not the book that you have to read at all if you want to get introduced in Tolkien.
Which is good news, I guess, because many people agree that the Silmarillion is really even more a chore than the original movies. Movies. We will segue into the movies, but I want to start to go more into the story itself right now, because I definitely agree with you that The Lord of the Rings is not a religious book by any means, or a book about more. It is a religious book, but not a book about religion. You know what I mean? But I think its main storyline, the fellowship and the breaking of the fellowship and all the trials and travails of Frodo and his suffering as he is bringing the ring to its destruction. It speaks to a, let's say, a core story of mankind. You know, it's a very universal story, and it's an incredibly strong story. And I think much of the success of the story itself is owed to this fact, whereas you would be hard-pressed to boil down the Song of Ice and Fire story that way. Song of Ice and Fire owes much more of its success to the characters, the character work, because the story structure itself, ice zombies are coming from the north and are going to kill everyone, is not exactly original.
It's very complicated. If you have to tell someone what is A Song of Ice and Fire is about, it's very complicated to say that very quickly. And you can see why the Lord of the Rings is about. Okay, you have to destroy a ring, so there is a company of people that is trying to destroy a ring. And if you destroy the ring, you win. So it's pretty easy. Of course, a lot of things are happening at the same time, but the story is very straightforward.
Yes, that is true. But I think the thing that makes The Lord of the Rings into the exciting and cathartic and generally emotionally engaging story that it is because the people in it are really suffering. You know, it is, they need to go the extra mile, at least Frodo and Sam. I don't know how it's in the books, but in the movies, there is this little disconnect where Gimli and Legolas are more for the fun part, you know, the whole war is fun thing. Aragorn is more for the epic stuff, and Frodo and Sam, they are going in for all of the for the suffering, for the human cost of it. And I mean, those are the two who in the end have the hardest send-off, basically, especially Frodo, who goes to Valinor after that, and all that stuff. It is, I mean, I'm just going to repeat myself. And then he kills Boromir, of course, which is one of the 9 main characters, so we are down to 8. And then Gandalf dies. Of course, he comes back, which you could agree with Martin is the biggest mistake Tolkien made. But still, people are dying. People are transforming. There are arcs. There are existential victories to be won. Human heart in conflict with itself, yada, yada. So you have all the pieces there that make a very good, a very compelling story. And I think that also helps for the staying power of it.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Lord of the Rings is about power. And fight about power is like the basis of like every interesting story, because you can fight for the power in your work in order to be like the most attractive guy for the ladies, or the guy that is going to be promoted, or in your sport team you want to be the star. In politics, of course, everything about power. Economics, it also the fights against countries is because power. And of the Rings is has the power also almost in the title, because the Lord of the Rings is the Lord of the Power, because the ring is the ring of power. So everything is due to the how people will do like everything for power or not. and how power affects the people. You can see perfectly in the movies and, of course, in the books, how Frodo, that was a very happy, very nice guy, was transformed almost in a beast at the end of the movies. You can, if you remember the last scene of the destruction of the ring, Frodo doesn't want to destroy the ring. The ring just fell because he's fighting versus Gollum in order to get it, and due to some pure luck, maybe God influence, something, a miracle, they both fight, and resulting of the fight, Gollum falls and the ring is destroyed. In the book, it's a bit different. In the book, Frodo at the end also fails to the ring and is like consumed to the ring. But there is a moment of salvation. There is a moment of redemption from Frodo, and after falling to the ring, he like becomes himself again when Gollum takes it, and he tries to push Gollum on purpose in order to destroy the ring, something like that. But you can see how power affects you. You can see, of course, in the Rohan plotline, you can see how King Theon is totally consumed by power due to the influence of Saruman. You can see, of course, Denethor. Denethor is one of the most interesting characters. In the movie, it's a bit like very simple villain, Denethor, you know, the Senescal of Minas Tirith, of Gondor. But in the book, he's a more complex character. He's not like a villain. He's a more... He doesn't want like to kill everyone in order to stay on power like 5 minutes more. It's a more compelling character. Galadriel, for example, in the movie, you can see her attraction to the ring. That moment when he's talking with Frodo and Rivendell, and you can see how terrifying she could she be if she would have taken the ring. Because in the Silmarillion, you can see that there is another side of Galadriel, that Galadriel is not a Cersei Lannister, but is a character that also is attracted to winning more power. So, of course, Gollum is a metaphor of what means when you are devoted to get the power, and how you actually became a beast, an animal, not a rational guy, in order to get the power. So that metaphor about power, for me, I think it's very powerful, and it really, it's the soul of the complex and the themes of the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think this is also the dimension that is the most difficult to grasp in the movies, because the true power of the ring is often referred to, but you never actually see it, because everyone who could use it to some effect, especially Gandalf and Galadriel, are resisting the temptation, because of course else the story would be over. But so we only see what the most humble of beings, which is Frodo, can do. And we never see people actually falling prey to its power, and this power unleashed, basically. I think we get a lot more of that in The Song of Ice and Fire, where Euron, for example, is in to show us quite a little bit what happens if Galadriel gets the ring, more or less. And this metaphor, basically, I feel, gets a little bit of the short thrift in the movies. And I think it's a lot stronger in the books, from what you are saying.
I have to say, when talking about the adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, I have to say I'm a huge fan of the adaptation. It has problems. It had big problems. For example, my favorite character maybe in the books is Gimli. And Gimli in the movies is a joke. It's a fun character that was created just in order to have fun. The interaction with Legolas are just in order to ridiculize and to become Gimli, a joke character. And in the books, he's a very complex character. It shows the pride of a very ancient race in the story of the Middle Earth, of the world. Dwarves were created even before the elves. They were like sleeping because they were created by accident before the elves, but it's a very ancient race. It's a very traditional, they sing a lot about the story. So it's a very complex character, very proud character, and in the movies it's just a funny character. So the movie have some problems, but I have to say I am very happy with the adaptation. There are more problems about Gimli. They have the scoring of the sign is very debatable. I think it was fine to take it away of the movie, but you can debate about that. Tom Bombadil, of course, is very... A lot of people argue against taking Tom Bombadil away of the movie. I think it's a smart move, but there are more questionable things. But I have to say I am very happy with the movies. But my point in this section was to say there is quite a respectable number of huge Tolkien fans that really hate. They in the Spanish fandom, we call him the Tolkien Inquisition, something like that, the Tolkien Inquisition, and because they totally hate the adaptation. And you can see that in the movie, some of the themes of the books are not so well shown as in the books, of course, and characters like Gandalf, like Frodo, Aragorn, you can see differences in the Glorfindel has disappeared. Okay, there are differences, but I said again, for me it's fine, but I'm sure you don't know. Maybe do you have a Stefan Son fan of it? Do you have any friend of that is a Tolkien fan that hates the movies? Because I don't have friends, but I have friends of friends that really hate the movies, being Tolkien fans.
No, I never met anyone who hated the movies and liked the books. I mean, I met a lot of people, I know a lot of people who don't like the movies, but that's because they don't like fantasy. But I've yet to meet people who read the books and say that the movies are really bad, so that they hate it. I mean, maybe there is the odd wistful thought about this or that should have been in, and this little detail that I care very much about is not in the movies. But that's about the extent of it. I mean, the debate that you are just touching on is the same with the Game of Thrones TV series. Yes, if you want the exact same experience, all the exact moments, motives, and etc. of the books on the screen, you will be disappointed. But this is true of every adaptation ever. And every attempt to get the most literal translation and adaptation on the screen has so far failed. And I would say this is not exactly random, but this is because it is a different medium. And so they have to make compromises, they have to change stuff, especially when it comes to such an unconventional story structure as The Lord of the Rings. So I understand it. I have much bigger problems with the Hobbit movies. I don't get...
Oh, they are... Yeah, it's for me, a Tolkien fan, of course, I love Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is the book that I have read more times in my life. And I just like The Hobbit. It's fine. It's a very nice starting story. It's a story that someone who is 10 years old could read and enjoy The Hobbit and won't lose like many big themes of the story because, to be honest, the Hobbit doesn't have a lot of big themes and complex narratives, something like that. But I appreciate, of course, that book because if you want to introduce young children to fantasy, maybe it's the best book. Just read The Hobbit. And the TV and the movies are terrible. I know why they made three movies in order to get more money, but the decision was so stupid from a narrative point of view. They dragged so many the story. They invented characters that were so ridiculous and so absurd in this context. And It was for me really sad because I thought, okay, after watching these movies, it's impossible that they will never, ever, ever do something related to Tolkien on a screen again. And we got the lottery because Amazon decided to create the Lord of the Rings that is not about Lord of the Rings TV show.
I'm really interested to see what happens there. But this is one thing. When we talk about the Lord of the Rings TV series that is going to come up, you know, the sheer fact that everybody is not losing their damn minds on the idea of a, like, what, 200 million budget per season TV series on the Lord of the Rings, and it's just like, yeah, that's a sign of the times. It just goes to show that we are deeply entrenched into the nerd stream era, right? I mean, this is... The Lord of the Rings is just one thing upon many. It's one more IP in the general fantasy, comic, science fiction, entertainment complex. It is incredible. So
I think that Amazon is not really promoting a lot of it yet because they made that video like it was like a trailer of a TV show, a trailer without a single scene of it because nothing has been recorded yet. People are now traveling. Well, people, the production is traveling now to New Zealand. Juan Antonio Bayona is a Spanish director, a movie director that made I don't know what's any name in English. Lo Imposible is called in Spanish. It was a movie that had a lot, what that was a huge success in in the US, and Jurassic World 2 that is horrible. The Impossible, you know, about a disaster drama film about, I don't know if you heard about it. Well, that the director, Spanish director Juan Antonio Bayona, is going to be the director of the pilot of the first chapter episode of the TV show Lord of the Rings. That is not Lord of the Rings, and he's now traveling to New Zealand because he today just spotted, okay, I am going to be in New Zealand when there are the new election in Spain, because politics in Spain is very funny. So we are going to have another election this year. We had one before. We had, in fact, four elections before this year, between a local and autonomic and European election and general election. That's going to be the fifth one. Crazy times in Spain. So the director said, okay, I'm going to be New Zealand while the election is going to be held, and I don't know if I will be able to vote by mail. And that, of course, confirmed something that were like teased by Amazon, that that TV show is going to be filmed in New Zealand. That also, as you know, the Lord of the Rings films, the regular films, were also filmed in New Zealand. So they are going to bring like a kind of continuity to the film. But for me, there is a problem, because they are always saying, okay, it's Lord of the Rings, but it won't cover anything of the movies. In fact, it's impossible that any single character of the movies can appear in the movie, in the TV show, except maybe Gandalf, maybe Galadriel and Elrond, but I think on Sauron. For me, the biggest point about the TV show is that Sauron won't be a tower with a red eye on top, but Sauron will be an actual character, a regular guy that walks around.
Yeah, then will be quite interesting to see. But let's return to the major narrative of the original Lord of the Rings story. And one of the points of contention, especially when it comes to movie adaptation, because I think the biggest decision, aside from cutting Tom Bombadil, is to cut the scouring of the Shire. Why do you think that is, and do you think it is a good decision?
Yeah, I think it's a good decision, because people is always joking that Lord of the Rings movie has a lot of endings. And it's true, because I remember watching it not so many time ago, like 3 or 4 months ago, something like that. I remember, okay, you have the climax when the ring is destroyed, and you had the scene where Gandalf is riding an eagle. I may talk later why the argument of, okay, just bring the ring to an eagle and the eagle would just fly to the Mount of Doom and just destroy the ring. That doesn't work in the Middle Earth. It's not as easy as that. So you have the very powerful scene with the music of the rings of the eagles saving Frodo and Sam from the fire. And then you have the big scene when Aragorn gets crowned in Minas Tirith and all the people are kneeling to the hobbits, because the hobbits were like the real heroes of the story. Okay, they were heroes, but Aragorn was also a hero, and Legolas and Gimli and Gandalf, but okay, I get it. And then you have the scene in the Shire when Frodo is in his house and he says, okay, I don't feel well, I don't belong here. And then you have then the scene in the docks when, okay, we are going to travel to the lands that are far away, where it's like a metaphor of dying, something like that. If you are not invested in this, you don't get why are they crying, because he's riding a boat. Okay, he's in a boat. He may come back in the same boat that he left. I don't know why. I remember when I was in the cinema, people say, okay, where are they living now? Maybe there is a fourth movie of Lord of the Rings that will be aired, showing the stories of what Frodo is going to do in that boat, or where Frodo is going to do to the place where he's going in that boat. And you have the final scene, of course, when Sam sees his wife again and says, okay, I am home. So that you have like all this I am talking about in like 20 minutes, half an hour. It's a very long period of time. If you add 10 more minutes of, you are, or 10 or 15 minutes that you are going to the Shire, that the Shire is destroyed because Saruman went there, and you have nice hobbits that are now like villains and almost like orc people that are there, and Grima there also doing machinations. It's too much. It's too much. And you have to make a TV movie, you have to make a movie, you have to know when to end it. And for me it was perfect. Maybe it was a bit longer that should have been the end of The Lord of the Rings, but you have to actually show those three key scenes. The crowning of Aragorn, the destruction of the rings and the eagles saving Frodo and Sam, and of course the final scene with the hobbits and Gandalf in the
book. I think the idea that the movies are not doing justice to all the themes and story beats from the movie from the books has its most justification when it comes to the Scouring of the Shire, because I definitely see that you are losing a major portion of what Tolkien wanted to say, you know, what he was getting at with this whole you cannot go home again thing, which you have with Frodo in a movie, but not with the rest of them. You know, I mean, Sam, especially with his final scene, he goes back to how it was, basically. And Pippin and Merry as well. And the Scouring of the Shire taken out is a loss on the one hand. But on the other hand, this is one of the major problems of Tolkien as a writer, because he just sucks at structure, basically. This is not a good idea, even in novels. In the movies, it would have been a catastrophe. It was clear from the get-go, I think, that the Scouring of the Shire would be taken out, would need to be taken out to get anything resembling a structurally sound movie.
But I have to say, Stefan, in the book, it really works very well, because it's not the same pace, it's not the same rhythm. The ring is destroyed, like, far before. We have a lot of chapters happening between the destruction of the ring and the actual scouring of the site. You have the company, the fellowship of the ring, actually saying goodbye to each other, and Legolas is going to Gimli to some caverns, and Aragorn is going to somewhere, and you have, of course, the Faramir and Eowyn love story that is more developed in the books, and you have a time to breathe, to actually relax, to have time to, okay, the story is going forward, let's see where it's going. And if you have read the book, and you have really read The Lord of the Rings, the first book, The Fellowship of the Ring, that half the book happens in the Shire, you are really invested in the Shire. So you really want to know what's happening in the Shire right now, because there were some strange visions that Pippin had and Frodo had about something strange happening in the Shire, and you really want to know what's happening in the Shire. So in the book, I think it works really, really very fine, the Scouring of the Shire, because also in the books, you don't see the ending of Gandalf, Saruman, and Grima. And you want to know, at least you haven't heard anything about them, and Saruman is a very, very important character in the story. So I think that in the book, it's a closure of themes, of narratives, or even characters as Saruman, that, in my opinion, works very, very well.
Yeah, okay, I can say that. So thanks for the perspective there. Now I'm feeling like the people who condemned Game of Thrones Season 8 just because the others were defeated in Episode 3, which is also not any sign of quality there. So I guess I finally have to reread the novels after all.
I am very happy now.
Yeah, I can guess so. I can't promise you that I will manage to do it this year, but let's just try and pledge myself to do it in 2020.
It's fine, because I think that we fantasy fans have now the task of reading The Witcher, because the Witcher TV show is going to air, I think, on December. And a lot of people, I have many friends that have read it and said, okay, it's not A Song of Ice and Fire, it's not Lord of the Rings, but it's very, very good. And it's very easy to read, very fun to read. They are not like 1,000 pages book like A Song of Ice and Fire. So you can read like I think there are 7 books, something like that, in like 1 month or 2 months and a half. So I think our, as geeks, as nerds, our homework now is to read The Witcher, and maybe in 2020, as you say, you can read The Lord of the Rings again.
Okay, then this seems like a fitting closing statement, unless you have something that you need to get off your chest.
I would repeat again that I am so honored to be here in this podcast. That about The Lord of the Rings, I would just say that, again, I understand if you don't like how Tolkien writes actually the book, because it's almost poetry, is high literature. But even if you don't like the book, I think as a nerd, you have to defend what Lord of the Rings have influenced the rest of us, because for me, like, invented fantasy. Some people say that fantasy is the oldest genre of the world, and I think it's an interesting debate, because maybe for another podcast, because you have, for example, Beowulf, that is fantasy. You have the Gilgamesh story, the Indian story, that's fantasy. So it's a very old genre that what reinvented the genre and transformed fantasy in what we understand now is fantasy. magic, wizards, elves, dwarves, magical objects that do crazy stuff and not real world where things are happening, dragons. It's Lord of the Rings. So he's like, Lord of the Rings is the father of all of us, and he's the father of all the nice fantasy literature that we all enjoy, and of course, A Song of Ice and Fire. So if George R. R. Martin says that he loves Lord of the Rings, and every 5 or 6 years he reads again Lord of the Rings, and of course he has some critics about Lord of the Rings, but he says he loves Tolkien and everything he has accomplished is because he's in the shoulder of a giant called John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, and if he's George R. R. Martin is because the R is Reuel Tolkien. So we have at least to give him some love. Give him some love. Maybe you don't like the book, maybe the movies are too long for you, but give him some love and try to defend it.
So let me just give the compliment right back. I am very honored to have you on, and thanks for agreeing to doing this. I hope everyone enjoyed this episode about the Lord of the Rings, even though you have one absolute neophyte into it who basically hates on the source material or anything. So next time we will talk about the Song of Ice and Fire proper once again. You will like the topic, I'm pretty sure of that. I'm not telling you right now what it will be, but it is a treat. I'm pretty sure about that. So thanks.
I will just introduce the topic for a future podcast, comparing Lord of the Rings characters with A Song of Ice and Fire characters, because there are a lot of parallels, and not just because one character is called Samwise and is the best friend of one of the biggest characters of both stories.
Okay, we'll need to do that at some future time. I will put it in the Google Doc in which I keep all the ideas for future episodes. By the way, if any one of our listeners has a gigantic idea what we need to talk about here on the podcast, even with a concrete guest suggestion or without it, please let me know. Send me an email, send me a message over Twitter, or comment on the Patreon. It will get to us. But if you have ideas, I'm always open for them. So thanks again, everyone, for listening. Thanks again, Javi, for coming on. And until next time, everyone.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by our Patreons from the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. The topic of the podcast was influenced by the Patreons as well, so if you are interested in having a say on what the topic of the next Boiled Leather Audio Hour will be about, check out the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. And if you are not interested in that, but interested in all the bonus content that you are getting, from exclusive essays to the audio version of said essays to early access to special podcasts and theory sessions and all of that, you can also check out the Patreon at, you guessed it, patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. So hopefully I'm seeing you again soon on this very podcast, and until then, have a very nice day, a very nice week, and however long it is until the next episode arrives.